Hey, it's Ben Greenfield here. One of the things that you'll learn about in today's podcast episode is how lack of sleep actually keeps your body from becoming a fat-burning machine.
Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right, Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life, you don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. Put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their sexual performance booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield, and I have to admit that one question I get quite a bit from folks, and I think this is because of the experiments I've done with myself on ketosis and turning myself into a fat-burning machine by following a high-fat diet or doing fasted workouts, things of that nature. One of the questions that I get from people is, how do you actually do it, right? Like, what would be the practical steps to become a fat burning machine, to shift yourself from carb to fat utilization? And so I figured, what the heck? Why not do a full podcast and give you all of the steps necessary to become fat adapted without doing metabolic damage to your body? Because frankly, it comes down to a little bit more than just like switching your breakfast from cereal to coconut oil and then throwing in a stick of butter for lunch. So I actually have on the call with me today a guy who's been a guest on the podcast before. His name is Barry Murray, and last year he came on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show to give us what he called the ultimate guide to combining fasting and exercise. And this is a guy who goes out and will do like full-on mountain runs, like day-long mountain runs in a completely fasted state. And we talked all about fasting, how to do it the right way when it comes to combining fasting and exercise, and some of the crazy workouts he's done in a fasted state while still managing to pull off pretty amazing and fast feats of physical performance. So Barry works with professional cyclists. He works with triathletes, distance runners. Last year, he worked as the sports nutritionist to the BMC professional cycling team. He's a competitive endurance athlete himself. He races in ultra marathon events. If you've been to greenfieldfitnesssystems.com, you may have noticed that Barry is also one of our coaches over there who works as a performance nutritionist and offers consultations through Greenfield Fitness Systems. So that's also a good place to look him up. So anyways, sit back and get ready to learn everything you need to know about how to become a fat-burning machine. Barry, thanks for coming on the call, man.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having us on again.
Yeah. So, you know, you've sent over to me in the past kind of like some of the steps that you like to bring athletes through as you work with them on their diet to becoming fat adapted. And I'd just like to jump right in, if we could, to what some of the first things someone should do when it comes to, well, basically the first step that you talk about is optimizing the general diet. Can you start there with, like, you know, somebody comes in off the streets, they're like, hey, I want to teach my body how to burn fat better. What do they do first from a dietary standpoint?
Sure. We'll take even a step back before that. And the question is actually defining what the fat adaptation is, because it's in the public a bit more these days. Fat burning machine is becoming more of a, you know, general term people are becoming familiar with. Low carb, high fat diets, keto adaptation is now becoming well. So very quickly, just to kind of set the tone here, fat adaptation, I find a lot of athletes are getting mixed up about what it actually means. So very quickly, basically what I'm trying to do with most endurance athletes that I'm working with, and what I believe is beneficial for most people in any athletic sense, is how can you upregulate the rate at which your body burns fat to produce energy? So simply then that means is, where have you got fat to burn? Most people know that you've got subcutaneous fat under the skin. So what you're trying to do is, the first term is lipolysis, and break down fats into your fatty acids, triglycerides, and send them to the muscle to get burnt. Second thing you're trying to do then is grow a bigger fat engine. So what you want to do then is upregulate beta oxidation. So that's the conversion of fatty acids into acetyl coenzyme A, which is your precursor then for the Krebs cycle.
And if I could just interrupt, we over here in America call it beta oxidation, in case anyone was confused. Barry calls it
tomato.
Beta oxidation. Okay, so we want to upregulate beta oxidation.
Yep. So again, you want to regulate that so that you can convert your as much at a higher rate as high an intensity at which you are exercising. Into, like I said, acetyl coenzyme A, and then you get that into the into the Krebs cycle, electron transport chain, ATP. What you're also trying to do is grow a bigger intramuscular triglyceride amount. So that's the fat stored in the muscle. You also want to improve gluconeogenesis. So you want to improve the way the body can make its own glucose, right? So I haven't even talked about ketones yet. And that is where people are going wrong, because people are thinking that the recommendation is you get into ketosis and that's what makes you fat adapted. It's not. There's a lot of steps and a lot of physiological mechanisms that first need to be put into place to simply increase the rate at which your mitochondria can burn fatty acids. And like I said, this spin-off of that is producing glucose.
Okay,
as well.
So basically we've got a few different ways that we can do this. We've got upregulating beta oxidation, or your body's ability to actually burn fat and turn it into ATP. We've got a better ability of the body to make its own glucose. You called it gluconeogenesis. So rather than relying upon like energy bars for glucose, we're somehow training our body how to make its own glucose.
Yes.
And then that other thing that you mentioned was the muscles' fat stores. I don't think a lot of people realize that the muscles actually store fat. Can you touch on that real quick about how it is that the muscles actually store fat or utilize fatty acids?
Yeah, exactly. Very quickly, people go out and buy a nice sirloin steak or even a T-bone steak. You're going to see white bits in it. That's obviously, most people know steak is muscle. The white bits are fat. Fat is can be stored in the muscle, and it's actually the storage amount is increased, particularly in endurance athletes. So if you slice open maybe my quad muscle, Ben, and you slice open, a 100-meter sprinter's quad muscle, the 100-meter sprinter's muscle is going to be a lot redder. And I would imagine my muscle has got a lot more white bits in it. In other words, that's what's called intramuscular triglycerides. In other words, it's fat stored in the muscle. Now, if you look at it from a purely logistical aspect, that doesn't need to travel very far to get burnt because it's in the muscle. It can just go directly in the mitochondria and then be used as fuel. Whereas the stuff that's under your skin obviously has to travel a lot further. So,
are you saying that having more fat inside your muscle is actually a good thing? Like in a fat adapted athlete, you generally have like basically more marbly muscle.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Totally. And through endurance training, that's being shown to increase. What the trick is to increase the rate at which you can. So in terms of, let's get some quantities here. I mean, there's actually not a huge amount of studies on it, but you're probably talking up to maybe 3,000, amount calories in terms of the amount that can be stored. I think it can go higher.
In muscle or just in the whole body?
In muscle.
Wow. So just in muscle alone, not accounting for like the fat you'd store like on your butt or hips or thighs or upper back or elsewhere, just the muscle alone can store around 30,000 calories of fat?
No, sorry, 3.
Oh, 3,000, which, yep. Well, I guess that's still twice as much as many carbohydrates as most people can
store,
right?
It's 1.5 times, theoretically, whatever you want to call it. In other words, yeah, you've got stuff in your muscle before you even touch what's under your skin that most people can use for most, general sports activities for longer in terms of like the quantity of fuel that's available. So IMTG is the shorthand version, intramuscular triglycerides. We can store a lot of them in the muscle. The more endurance exercise you do, the more you store, and the more you train the body and upregulate beta oxidation, I'll pronounce it the right way this time, is obviously you will be able to burn more of that stuff without then that you've got the big glycogen, you're saving, glycogen sparing then is going on just from that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think a lot of people just think about fat burning as just basically upregulating the amount of fat that you burn versus carbohydrate that you can burn. But it's so interesting how there's all these other physiological mechanisms that you're talking about that I think fly under the radar. So it's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm you know what? There's still other stuff like the pentose phosphate pathway, which I'm not going to get into at the moment, but there's other stuff, there's other things going on in terms of how the cell can produce energy without having to ingest and burn carbohydrates. So so I haven't even mentioned ketones and ketosis, but I've already discussed several pathways, mechanisms, fuel sources, which we need to train a lot to make our bodies more efficient at the way they burn those fats, transport those fats, get them into the mitochondria, and the rate at which they can be burnt. So people, you know, there's a lot of things going on that people aren't aware of, and therefore they get a little bit, you know, lost in what they're actually trying to achieve and buy keto strips and think that, you know, just measuring and producing ketones is what they need to do to be fat adapted. But like I said, I've just described what fat adaptation is, and it doesn't even involve ketones up until that point, so to speak.
Okay, so I know that we're going to talk a little bit about both training strategies as well as lifestyle and environmental strategies, but also food strategies. And I think like step one that you wanted to get into was what you do as far as optimizing your general diet to get into this state where all these moving parts are allowing you to be a fat burning machine. So what, like when someone first comes to you, what are you guys doing from a dietary overhaul standpoint?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the first thing I would spend time on is like there's a lot of food education required. So the bottom line is that this is a long-term process. It's not a overnight transformation. It's not a magic bullet. It's not something you do for 2 weeks. It's something that you do long-term. And the longer you do it, the better it becomes. So in order for that to be long-term, you need to create a way of eating that's habitual. Therefore, you need to obviously do it in the right way. The right way would be based around obviously a lower carb, higher fat type of diet with the food based on, you know, the Paleolithic type foods. Now, I mean, I'm not even 100% Paleolithic myself, and I would probably recommend something like using the Paleo Code approach. I think it's Chris Kresser who has that book out. Mm-hmm. Where I try to get guys, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of professional cyclists, and, you know, telling them that they can't eat, you know, certain grains and certain dairies and even, you know, certain legumes, et cetera, you know, it has to be a practical way of eating that somebody can do for the long term. So you need to understand that there's certain foods that do not need to be 100% excluded. You need to then introduce, you know, you need to educate people about, you know, what, you know, different qualities of food and the different, you know, the nutrient densities of foods and things like that, the right types of fats to eat, you know, obviously explain the kind of quality in terms of the let's say grass-fed beef, et cetera, all those kind of things, which most okay. people listening to this show would know. And the final thing I would say that goes in with the food-based thing, Ben, is like the coping strategies, because trying to get somebody to go from, let's say, eating, you know, bowls of oatmeal in the morning and, you know, still, let's call it in inverted commas, safe carbs of, you know, sweet potatoes and all that kind of stuff. And then trying to get them to go on a dramatically, you know, remove those things from their diet and go on a very, you know, just high fat, moderate protein and 50 grams of carbohydrate a day. You know, most people aren't able to do that. And it usually means that people fall flat on their face after, you know, about a few days of trying it, basically. So
because they're restricting carbohydrates excessively?
That and the fact that people are simply not, I mean, one of the biggest kind of appetite dietary things that we have to overcome is sugar, our sensitivity to sugar and our sweet tooth. Everybody has it. And it's one of the biggest challenges I find dealing with, you know, initially when I'm dealing with athletes is trying to say, listen, you know, go and eat some cream instead of a sugary yogurt, right? And the simple fact is that we are sensitized, and the, obviously the more simple sugar, carbohydrate foods, and never mind the sweet stuff, but even just simple sugar type foods, is that that's switching on a lot of the kind of receptors for the sweet hit. Yeah. And you need to desensitize the brain and desensitize your taste buds, so to speak, so that you can actually eat for the long term a much higher, like a much more savory diet. Because you start throwing in, you know, people in the paleo world doing things like, you know, yeah, they remove sugar and they remove white flour and stuff like that, but they put in like half a container of honey instead, right? And as you know, honey is just fructose and glucose anyway. So while it's in a, like it's more natural and probably healthier for you, it's still, you know, it's still a glucose and a fructose at the end of the day. So there's a lot of get into proper low carb, high fat way of eating.
Okay, so I'm curious, when we get down into brass tacks here, when you're looking at like an active athletic person who's exercising quite a bit, you know, most of our listeners are at least exercising, you know, 30 minutes a day, most exercising 60 plus minutes a day. What exactly would a typical day of eating look like in someone who is trying to become fat adapted? Like what would be like an ideal day for you if you could just like ship a meal to someone for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, and for their snacks?
I mean, again, if it's somebody who's just kind of looking into this and trying this and they're not a full-time, you know, athlete or an elite athlete, some of the simple dietary changes I would make would be like, you know, just first maybe get them just to switch to, you know, a completely kind of lower GI type of carbohydrate food. So, you know, maybe particularly obviously in Ireland, porridge or oatmeal would be quite a commonly eaten breakfast. But, you know, I would try and, first of all, lower the GI content of their food. So, you know, I start recommending breakfasts like, you know, instead of just cereals and stuff like that, I might just recommend obviously a lot of eggs-based breakfasts. If people are not into eggs, I start just getting them on, say, Greek yogurt and mixing that in with different nuts and maybe some seeds and berries and things like that. So you're gradually always lowering the carbohydrate amount. And then, you know, for lunches and dinners, basically keeping them to like, you know, lower GI veggies, obviously sweet potatoes, or just like fibrous, non-starchy type veggies and salad dishes with meats. And then all the, you know, kind of, I always make a point of kind of including the higher fat foods, like, you know, just simply like avocados and, you know, using coconut oil and butter and stuff like that. It's kind of like another big mistake people make is they start eating like chicken and broccoli, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm kind of like, well, you know, you're basically just eating some fiber and some protein. And the whole point of this is that you want to activate the enzymes that actually switch on fat burning. And one of the things that does that is actually eating a higher content of fat. So, you know, fats need to be put in more so than any of the other macronutrients. So, and that's a huge mindset change for people. I mean, I'm dealing with people who for most of their life have been hearing about, you know, how fats are bad for them. So, you know, telling people to go and eat beef dripping and lard and stuff like that is a huge mental battle for people. So, but I mean, to go back to your very original question, lower GI type meals, using kind of, you know, things like sweet potato and oatmeal and fibrous veggies, and keeping their so, you know, really just trying to work on the whole point of, you know, managing the insulin response, upregulating fat hormone sensitive lipase, which breaks down fats, by including higher amounts of fats.
So you can actually upregulate your amount of lipase by adding extra fats to meals.
Yeah. So yeah, so I mean, so one of the enzyme that looks after conversion of triglycerides into fatty acids is hormone sensitive lipase, and that's, first of all, that's inhibited by a high insulin response. So obviously, then you eat a big bowl of cereal with toast, you're going to inhibit that that enzyme, and the other thing that activates it then is a higher is our actual fats, in particular saturated fats. So you can switch that enzyme on and you can switch it off if you want. So
yeah,
that's why understanding about the types of foods you're eating is critical, you know?
Okay. Well, I want to jump into the actual timing in a second here, but what it sounds to me like, because this is something I'll do a lot of times with the athletes who I'm talking to, is we'll pretty much like do a normal kind of like healthy diet, what might even be considered a paleo diet or an ancestral diet, or even like something like kind of a Weston A. Price diet where they're even eating, you know, some things like quinoa or sourdough bread or properly prepared grains and things of that nature. But you pretty much add in a bunch of grass-fed butter, MCT oil, olive oil, chopped up avocados and chopped up olives, some added cheeses, while at the same time as you're adding those, just detracting from the carbohydrate portion of the meals a little bit. And that's like, in my opinion, I've found that to be a very natural approach where you're just telling people, hey, drench this stuff in a little bit more oil, add some more healthy fats, decrease the carbohydrate portion. And just from a dietary standpoint, that just kind of gradually nudges your body towards fat burning rather than you, you know, as you say, having to like, you know, dip your spoon into lard for lunch, have a bulletproof coffee every single morning, and then basically, you know, eat three avocados for dinner. I think that that's, you know, that's like
exactly
that drastic, super duper low carb approach that some people take because they saw whatever, you know, I don't know, Jimmy Moore, bless his heart, eating a stick of butter at, you know, for lunch. And it's like, yeah, that's certainly something that people on the pointy edge of this stuff will do. But like, that's not what you necessarily have to do, especially if you're active to become a fat burning machine, right?
Exactly. Basically, exactly what you said there is exactly the approach people need to be taking. And more so, not just from, you know, the practicalities of it, but you know, in the background, when I'm working with somebody, I'm thinking that means that they're going to stick to that. There's a much better chance they are going to stick to that long term. And like I said, the fat adaptation approach and turning yourself into a fat burning machine is a long term project. It's a, you know, at least several months, and I'm going into now 4 or 5 years of doing this myself, and I'm still working on it and getting better at it. So what you described there in terms of what people are foods that most healthy people are going to like eating.
Yeah.
And there's not huge sacrifice in terms of what they have to leave out there either. So
right. It's like eat healthy, add extra fats. Okay. So that's step one, is to make that dietary change. It's kind of the obvious one, but that's helpful that, you know, to know about the common mistakes that people make. Now, step two that you talk about is nutrient timing. And I'd like to hear about that and how nutrient timing fits in with the daily schedule as far as like when you're structuring these foods.
So kind of the next step I use then is the timing of what people eat and how, and I'm always relating that back to what's that switching on and what's that switching off in terms of hormonal responses, enzyme inhibiting enzyme activation. So to go in line with what we said about the kind of long-term effect or long-term project that this involves, I am in terms of continuing eating a certain level of carbohydrate means I don't get them to just eat, you know, the same amount with each meal during the day. So one of the first timing things I would introduce is backloading. So backload the carbs. So if it's somebody who's, I always use a weekend as an easy way to describe it, I'm saying, look, if you go out and you do your training in the morning and you go out and you do an hour run or a couple of hours cycle or swim or play a match, whatever it is, obviously CrossFitters out there as well. So I would usually say, look, don't eat your carbs before you go. You want to go into your training session generally in as low an insulin state as possible with the fat engine doors open. Therefore, you know, have an eggs-based breakfast or have a, you know, very low GI, low carbohydrate amount of food for your breakfast and train. And when you come back, eat the majority of your carbs for the day with your lunch or when your next meal is. And, you know, then, you know, don't have a big, you know, bowl of pasta in the evening. Go back to a much lower carbohydrate meal or much lower GI at least.
Did you know that, because I just interviewed him for my Rev conference, but John Kiefer, when I talked to him, because he's kind of like one of the guys who originally came up with this whole like carb backloading, workout in the evening and then eat all your carbs in the evening type of approach. What he was telling me was that pretty much whether or not you work out in the morning, in the afternoon, or in the evening, that the best time to eat your carbs, just because of the circadian rhythm relationship with insulin, is in the evening. Even if you work out in the morning, he was saying, you know, even if you're doing like a morning workout, continue to eat high fat in the morning, eat high fat in lunch, and continue to save all your carbohydrates for the evening. Are you familiar with that approach at all, or have you experimented with that?
Yeah, I am familiar with it. And the reason why I would be I would be against it from the perspective of there's other stuff going on in the immediate. So it's all about the context as well. I mean, if you're okay, in my context, I'm dealing with, you know, pro cyclists a lot. So getting them to say go out and do a 4-hour pretty hard session on the bike with big efforts, when they've got 5 hours the next day, and their cortisol is through the roof from that 4-hour session, and you know, adrenals are working overtime, glycogen synthase is activated post exercise, immediately post exercise. I know there's benefits to what John Kiefer's saying, but I'm always looking at the context of the situation, and the benefits of putting, if you're a high volume, regularly, you know, training athlete, competitive athlete, I still favor on the side of backloading immediately post your training session. Okay. The fact that it's going to lower the inflammation. It's going to lower the cortisol response. It's going to take advantage of simply, you know, getting a better glycogen replenishment. I don't know if there's even some sort of like appetite signaling response where, you know, if you eat some carbs post training, I think that down the line helps kind of appetite response later on in the evening. There's other things like astrocytes, which are the kind of the glucose storage units in the brain that actually get replenished very quickly post training as well. So like everything with, you know, nutrition, there's pros and cons to everything. So I think you can definitely, I mean, there's new research coming out now where they're saying, you know, don't put any carbs in post training, you get much better training adaptations. And like there's a researcher in Australia coming out with some good papers on that now, John Hawley, I think his name is. But again, I go back to the point of who is it you are talking about. If it's a, you know, an Ironman doing 20 hours a week and they've got, you know, a couple of sessions coming up the next day, or like I said, cyclists and runners who've got big volume sessions coming up the next day and are highly stressed from the session that they've just done, I'm still a backloading approach from the terms of put it in post exercise.
Okay, gotcha. And what I generally do, and I know that a lot of people listening in are kind of moving or doing some kind of exercise session twice a day, is the way that I currently have my diet set up, and you know, I've written articles about this, so I've gone into the labs and I've been tested. I'm very, very well fat adapted myself, but my main strategy is I get up in the morning and I do some very light, kind of like what would be considered easy parasympathetic nervous system rest and digest based activity, meaning I'll do yoga, a light walk, some light movement, some mobility work, some foam rolling. I generally accompany that with caffeine from just like a black cup of coffee, not a cup of coffee with a bunch of calories added to it, like MCT oil and butter and stuff like that. Just a regular calorie less cup of black coffee. And then also cold shower, both before and after that morning fasted fat-burning session. And the way that I do things is after that, I'll eat breakfast, but my breakfast is basically like plants plus fats. So I'm blending up like fats and plants in a blender, and, you know, kale, MCT oil, coconut milk, almonds, nuts, stuff like that. And then generally like in the afternoon or the early evening, when body temp peaks and reaction time peaks and my body's really primed for a very tough workout, I'll do about 45 to 60 minutes of high intensity interval training. And generally at some point within 2 hours after that, I'll have dinner. And that dinner is my primary bolus of carbohydrate for the day. So for a two-a-day scenario, that's actually worked very, very well for me. And that would be, I guess you might term that like a cyclic ketotic approach, because cyclic ketosis means like I'm pretty much in ketosis all day long. And when I eat that final evening meal and I have, you know, typically it's anywhere from like 150 to 200 grams of carbohydrate with that evening meal, I'm out of ketosis for usually about like 2 to 3 hours. So I'm out of that full on fat burning state. And then I'm back into it either by that night or by the next morning. And that's the approach that I use as far as a timing standpoint. And it works pretty well for me.
Yeah, perfect. But there's one big difference there. What you've said in the morning is, like you said, you use some light exercise, some parasympathetic stuff, which is absolutely fine. I mean, where I'm coming at is, if you come for a 2 hour run with me in the mountains, try and come back and just have black coffee and not. That's what I'm, you know, that's the difference. But in terms of your context, that works absolutely fine. And I even do that, you know, anyone who listens to the last podcast that I did with you, I am all about the fasting. And that's what I've kind of like, use that similar approach myself. I'm a 2 meal a day guy a lot of the times. When I'm not training, say running in the morning or cycling in the morning, I do mobility work and a bit of MoveNat stuff. And like a lot of kind of like, movement type, you know, squats and things like that, and just light exercise. And then I won't eat either until lunchtime, basically. So it just comes down to the kind of volume and intensity of the work, I think, that you're doing.
Yeah, got it. Okay, cool. So we've got step one being to optimize the general diet. Step two being nutrient timing. And I'm sure that our listeners can hear that there's somewhere a baby crying, and that's because...
That's not my side.
Yeah, that's not my baby either. It's someone else's baby somewhere. This podcast is being brought to you by the Spokane, Washington Library. So anyways, number three would be fasted state training. And this probably segues pretty nicely from what you were just talking about and what we were discussing regarding fasting. Where does fasted state training come in as far as the best way to do it to turn yourself into a fat burning machine? How much is too much? Like what's your take on the whole fasted scenario and where that fits in?
This is where I've kind of spent a lot of my time researching, reading about, and practicing. And I think in terms of the adaptations that you need to get to become, you know, a super highly efficient fat burner, and a massive mitochondrial growth biogenesis, a massive mitochondrial efficiency, a massive cytochrome 1, let's call it, activation, you can get the biggest adaptations through fasting, and in my case, what I call fasted state training. So anyway, again, we covered a lot of this in the last podcast, but what this, when you look into it, is what happens is the main thing that happens in the mitochondria is you get a stress response and a stress signaler protein called AMP kinase. And AMP kinase is the guy that comes in and goes, we're not getting any fuel in here, we're exercising, things need to change. And what happens then is you get expression of transcription factors and other protein signaling molecules. So you get the sirtuin, SIRT1, you'll get PGC1, you'll get PPAR alpha. And what all these things do are they are messengers to say, we need to start building more mitochondria here. We need to start burning more fats here because we're not getting any carbs in. We need to, you know, start making more glucose even. And we need to become much more efficient with what we have. And it's a simple case of not giving the body anything, in other words, not giving it any fuel. So what you can do there is utilize two strategies. I think they're the two biggest strategies that you can get to making your body adapt and getting getting improvements is intermittent fasting, stroke fasting. So, you know, 16 to 18 hour fasts or longer. And the second thing you can do is what I've been doing for the last several years is get up in the morning and train without breakfast. Because like I said, that's where you're going to get all the biggest, the biggest stress responders all switched on. Big AMP kinase release, all the adaptations that I'm talking about in terms of upregulation of beta oxidation, mitochondrial biogenesis. And so, you know, the practical aspects of doing this is people hear about this. It's another thing that's kind of, you know, in the public a bit more and being talked about and podcasted about and blogged about. People are like, yeah, okay, I'm going to try this weekend. I'm going to go and, you know, go on a 3-hour bike ride and just have, you know, coffee in the morning and bring a bottle of water with me and a stick of butter. But the point is, again, your body has to be adapted in order to do it. So I bring people again gradually into it. So, you know, it would be a case of doing whatever your easiest session of the week is, try and just do that in the fastest state once a week, see how you get on. Or, you know, try and go out on an easy long run or long bike ride. I mean, it depends on the type of athlete you are, obviously. And, you know, just go fasted after the first hour, you know, eat something. And then maybe in a couple of weeks' time, try and bring it out to an hour and a half. And then after a couple of months, bring it up to 2 hours. I mean,
how often do you recommend doing, because I currently do it once a week. I go out and do something fasted that takes me a longer period of time once a week. Now, of course, I'm not competing as a competitive ultra endurance athlete or, you know, multi-day cyclist or a mountain marathon or anything like that, right? So I probably fall into the category of more of our listeners who are not necessarily ultra endurance athletes, but who are just like, you know, kind of doing triathlons, maybe marathons, things along those lines, if they're doing long stuff at all. But do you think once a week is sufficient? Is that too much for like a longer fasted fat burning session? Or what do you think for the general population would suffice?
I like usually starting off with one. And usually the weekend kind of longer, let's say whatever the longer type session is. And then like building on that, as in, you know, like I said, doing it once a week, and let's say it's a long bike ride or a long run, like eating after the first hour and then extending that as you go. So yeah, I mean, I think twice a week it can be safely done by pretty much everyone. So, you know, where you do something maybe Wednesday and then you do something fasted, that is Wednesday, and then fasted Saturday or Sunday. I mean, okay. I've gotten to the stage where, you know, I took it to the extreme, and I was doing it maybe 6 times a week, and I'm doing quite big volume sessions, but that's how you can dig a big hole for yourself. But I think the benefits, you'll get huge benefits by doing it once to twice a week, and doing it once to twice a week drastically reduces any risks that come with that.
Yeah, and I'm kind of, again, just to use myself as an example, just so people know, I pretty much do at this point a fasted session almost every morning. That's that shorter 20 to 30 minute fasted session. Literally, that's like 6 days a week. And then on one day of the week, it's a longer fasted fat burning session. But I'm pretty much doing a fasted workout at this point in my life almost every day of the week. And staying lean is a total no-brainer. And I can literally stuff my face with my wife's solid cooking at dinner, especially if I'm doing that after a post-hard evening workout, and it works out really well. So I love the fasted state training, and I think it's another one that some people forget to include in becoming fat adapted because they're, whatever, afraid that fasted training is going to be too catabolic or something like that. But ultimately, I think as long as you're keeping it aerobic and it's not like a bunch of strung together fasted CrossFit workouts, for example, it works out really well.
Exactly. So I recommend people not doing back-to-back days. So that would be, you know, one thing people start doing. They're like, oh, fasted, I burn more fat, so I get really lean, get really ripped, blah 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 blah. And they start doing it, you know, all the time, and that's how you really dig yourself a grave, basically.
Yeah, I agree, unless the fasted workouts are really easy. And I find that if the fasted workouts are really easy, like we're talking yoga and stuff like that, I'm able to do it every day.
Oh yeah, totally.
I feel fine. But it, yeah, once you get into like the hard, like long fasted workouts, or the hard and long, hard or long, that's where it starts to dig you into a hole. Absolutely. Okay, so step one is to optimize our diet. Step two is to time our nutrients throughout the day. Step three is to include fasted state training. Step four, you talk about lifestyle and environmental factors that affect your ability or non-ability to turn yourself into a fat burning machine. What are some lifestyle and environmental factors people need to take into consideration here?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is a big area, and the more I'm trying to explain these things, the more I realize, you know, we have to skim over the surface of a lot of stuff. But, you know, I guess one of the big things that will be in, you know, familiar to people a lot, and it seems to be in like the media and the news a lot these days, is sleep. And, you know, I would have a lot of people, a lot of athletes who, let's say they're eating, you know, paleo-ish and lower carb and fasted state training, but their sleep is crap, and, you know, they're not getting solid night's sleep. And then you look into the effects of sleep, and you look at its effect on insulin sensitivity, cortisol patterns. You look at its effect on prolactin and melatonin, and you start going, well, you know, he might be eating all the wild Alaskan salmon in the world and having really good extra virgin coconut oil and, you know, eating all, you know, his greens, etc. But if his insulin sensitivity isn't working, that means his nutrient partitioning isn't as good. And if his cortisol pattern isn't good during the day, that means his again, it's going to affect fat adaptation and appetite signaling. And, you know, so sleep obviously will be one of the first things I always look at. And then I would apply all the kind of biohacks that you can apply these days to sleep. You know, you don't have to look too far these days to find out what are the improvements or what are the things, solutions you can use to improve in sleep. The other thing then I look at, and this kind of goes a bit deeper, is, you start looking into really how the body works and the body functions, and you start looking at all the physiological and the biochemical mechanisms, which I spent most of my life doing. And then you start kind of looking in a bit deeper, and you start looking at the quantum mechanics that are involved in how the cell works. And it starts making you realize that it's a lot to do with, you know, quantum physics, which unfortunately was a subject I didn't actually study. But anyway, but what I'm saying in here is that, you know, there's a lot to do with, say, redox or redox, reduction and oxidation reactions. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much how cell signaling can work. And if the cells are not signaling well to each other, and reduction is gain of electrons and oxidation is loss. So therefore, you start going into the kind of aspect of, well, what's actually affecting this person's body and the way the cells communicate with each other and the way electrons are transported and the way how that affects making the body work and making ATP, etc. And you start going, and then you start looking into lifestyle factors that affect the way reduction and oxidation reactions are affected. And that comes down to things like, well, if you put something that's not an electromagnetic force, that's not native, close mm-hmm. to you, then that's going to disrupt.
You're talking like a cell phone or a Wi-Fi router.
Yeah,
or something,
yeah,
like
exactly.
That.
Then that's going to disrupt your oxidation and reduction reactions, and that's going to affect electron transport, and that's going to affect the way your mitochondria work. So, and what's a non-native electromagnetic force? Well, yeah, iPads, iPhones, laptops, everything that people are stuck to these days. So, this is where I've kind of come to the realization that it's not necessarily, I mean, I'm a nutritionist and I've spent a lot of my time obviously understanding food and researching food, but now what governs the way, you know, your physiology works and what determines how efficient you can become and how, you know, healthy you can become, essentially, is through these factors, these lifestyle factors that actually are affecting the way your cells operate. And that, like I said, one of the things then would be, you know, dirty electricity, whatever you want to call it, non-native EMFs. And you start, look, if somebody is trying to get, you know, lean, healthy and become a fat burner machine and race an Ironman and sub 10 hours on 50 grams of carbohydrate, and they're sitting in bed with their iPad on and they're stuck to their iPhone all day, this chances are they're not going to become as ketotic or fat adapted or efficient as they should be.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the failures today in people's kind of athletic prowess, if you call it, want to call it, and certainly in people's health, is are things like this. So next to sleep would be, you know, people's exposure to, you know, electromagnetic, non-native electromagnetic frequencies. And I'm working with a lot of athletes to try and get them off that stuff. And
that's one of the biggest barriers that I run into with the clients who I'm working with, is they're willing to do the exercises that I load up for them. Like I use Training Peaks, for example, and I give them their workouts and their exercises for each day. And I use Evernote is what I use right now to deliver my clients their meal plans and their nutrients or recipes to follow. But then when it comes to sleep, when it comes to shutting off the cell phone, when it comes to hardwiring into the Wi-Fi router, when it comes to a lot of these, you know, even hidden inflammatory factors like changing up the brand of shampoo that you use or changing what you're cleaning your kitchen counter with, like some people think you can just exercise and eat yourself into a state of optimized fat burning efficiency. And the fact is, you got to have every lifestyle factor present. And of course, that goes way above and beyond just fat burning efficiency. That goes into like everything from freaking like anti-aging to mental performance to, you know, just looking, feeling, and performing fantastically throughout the day. I think that the other important thing to take into consideration here when you look at inflammation in general, you know, which can of course be caused by dietary factors, but can also be caused by some of these other, you know, hidden dangers that we talked about, is, I mean, it's been shown to cause insulin resistance, like in fat tissue. When you have inflammation, you're resistant to insulin, so you get less fuel partitioned into muscle. You get leptin resistance. I know that especially like inflammation of the brain or the hypothalamus. And so you get dysregulation of appetite and metabolism, which can inhibit your ability to stay in a fat burning state. And then gut inflammation, you know, that's another biggie here, is you can produce more what are called lipopolysaccharides. And that's essentially an endotoxin that's produced by bacteria in your gut. And that can also cause inflammation and insulin resistance, especially in the liver, and that can inhibit your ability to become a fat burning machine too. So yeah, people got to take care of their brains. They got to take care of their guts. They got to look at their environment. And I appreciate that you include that as a strategy, because that's a huge one that a lot of people don't pay attention to.
Yeah, totally. And basically what you've just said has made is that everything is connected, and nothing, you know, to do with what we're talking about here, fat burning, is not simply eat 50 grams of carbs a day and eat a stick of butter and drink some bulletproof coffee. So all of those things that you just mentioned actually do impact on, you know, like how you can become fat adapted, because like you said, it's down to, we're controlling inflammation. And you've just discussed what those things affect. I mean, the other lifestyle factor I bring in is actually, well, what's one of the things that actually causes an anti-inflammatory effect? And that would be getting people out and grounded and connecting, you know, barefoot. So, you know, using grounding and also the cold, like you use cold daily. Mm-hmm. But again, they're easy things. They don't cost anything. But yet again, people overlook them or don't understand them, because there is quite deep science behind them. But people assess them as being kind of hippie, airy-fairy kind of things. But when you look deep into them, there's some serious, like, again, back to the kind of quantum mechanics effects of how these things work. But yeah, earthing, grounding, and cold are very strong anti-inflammatory mechanisms that you can use. Sleep, EMF, cold, grounding, and you've got probably things going on there that impact your fat burning capabilities more so than the free range eggs you eat in the morning.
Yeah, so if you're that person substituting roasted vegetables with olive oil instead of the mashed potatoes at the restaurant, but then you're standing up when you get a phone call and holding that cell phone up to your ear, you're putting water on the fire on one end and gasoline on the other end. So make sure you optimize all those lifestyle factors. Now, Barry, a lot of the people that listen to this podcast, and of course I know a lot of people that you work with, they're also competing, right? They might be competing in CrossFit. They might be competing in triathlon and marathon and obstacle course racing, whatever. Once you've got the correct food base and eating structure in place and some of these lifestyle factors in place, when it comes to actually competition and what you're into folks eating or fueling with during competition or any type of supplementation used before big workouts or competition to keep yourself in a fat-burning state, what are some of the big wins that you're implementing right now?
A lot of it comes down to just the practicalities of being in airports, being on planes, being in a hotel, not being at home with your own kitchen supply and your own fridge. So some of the things, you know, I would be always recommending people bring kind of stuff with them that's kind of, you know, bring, I always bring kind of fresh coffee with me, and maybe bring things like, you know, coconut oil, a jar of coconut oil, for instance, bring some, you know, 100% raw cocoa powder, and just a lot of the kind of like daily healthy and kind of fundamental things that would be important to, as I said, like kind of like keeping you in, you know, using things like the you know, things like coconut oil, things like I can't think off the top of my head now what else I'd be recommending guys to people. There's obviously a limit to what you can bring, but there's some,
you mean
some
when you mean when you're traveling, you mean?
Yeah, when traveling.
One big one I like is pemmican. You can like I get mine from this company called US Wellness Meats, and it's just rendered fat that's mixed with sea salt as a little bit of a preservative. That stuff travels pretty well. And it's really, really good. I also pretty much every single time I step onto an airplane for a day of travel, I've got a couple of avocados and a can of sardines in my bag. And what I'll do is I'll grab a green salad from Starbucks or from any of the other airport vendors, and I just like chop up an avocado and dump open a can of sardines on that. And that's pretty much like my go-to meal when I'm in the airport and trying to avoid a lot of sugar boosting type of compounds.
Yeah, exactly. And suddenly, through what is quite a simple, simple kind of an effort that you, a couple of avocados and a tin of fish, you know, you've suddenly kind of kept your, you know, insulin levels low, kept your fat pathways open, and you haven't had a big ciabatta or a panini or a baguette or whatever else is usually available in airports, which is sometimes what a lot of, you know, fat adapted serious athletes have to resort to. And it can, there are simple fixes like what you just described, or prevention mechanisms, let's call them. Other things, like, you know, I like using branched chain amino acids. They're kind of things that are quite portable and easy to bring. Magnesium in transdermal form, so in the spray form. So you know, they're kind of easy things to travel with and usually effective to kind of keep with. Then there's the big aspect of fueling during the race. And this is quite a controversial topic because I'm not in favor of the, so I'm, you know, known for being very into the whole fat adaptation mechanisms, fasted state training, lower carb diets. But when racing, there's different things that are going on, and I believe one of the biggest factors is the central governor, as in the brain. And one of the things that runs on, apart from ketones, as we know, but one of the easy fuels it runs on is glucose. And I think a lot of athletes today are actually overdoing the, you know, trying to race on, say, you know, cheese and dried meat and nuts, and the long starch polymer carbohydrate drink, when really insulin remains dormant during these races. Therefore, you do not spike insulin if you have some carbohydrate. And it is actually small glucose hits in the form of some fruit or dried fruit or a natural energy bar, flapjack, or a natural nut a type gel with some natural honey in it or something like that, is that actually helping the central governor from crashing? If you're doing an Ironman, for instance, because I had clients who went to Kona Ironman just in October, gone. Mm-hmm. And, they're very fat adapted, but they need to race using carbs. Now, you don't need to use the whatever 90 grams of carbs an hour factor, because you're not fueling the muscle, so to speak, but you're fueling the brain. So, a lot of the time, I'm trying to get guys to not have the standard gels and standard sports drinks and things like that, but have the lower carb type, let's say, gels and sports drinks, and also just simply use natural carbohydrate fruits and bars during what, let's say it is a race of, marathon and longer distance, or, fast Olympic distance type triathlon. Any of the shorter stuff, I don't think you need to be fueling with glucose, so to speak. But that's kind of a big area that I think people are getting wrong. And it's something that's throwing off the fat adaptation kind of principles. Not the principles, but the benefits a bit, because people are thinking that they have to race with, just a stick of lard, and they can't have a banana when... Mm-hmm. When the opposite is true, and when actually glucose actually favors the brain central governor mechanism during intense exercise.
Okay. So is there, for example, if you look at like Gatorade Sports Science Institute, they're saying a minimum of 200 to 250 calories of carbohydrate per hour during exercise. Some athletes, like I used to be up around 400 calories of carbohydrates per hour during Ironman. Do you have a certain number of calories per hour of carbohydrate that you found to be able to maintain performance while still keeping the body in a relatively fat utilizing state?
Really hugely depend on the athlete and how long they've been adapted and how long they've been following this strategy. But I mean, I think a competitive, let's say sub 10 hour, or sub 3 hour marathon runner, and I've done this myself, you can operate on 20, 30 grams of carbohydrate an hour, because that's enough to fuel the brain. What's that in calories? That's like 100, 150 calories. Now what you need to do is be highly fat adapted so that you're up in the zones of exercise of whatever it is you're competing at, zone 3, zone 4, where you are in 100, where your respiratory quotient is good enough that you are comfortably racing in a almost 100% fat burning mode, so you're not utilizing much glucose. And like I said, the main glucose that you're using is actually for the brain. I've won some big ultra marathon races where I've probably consumed on average something like less than 100 calories an hour, but that would be over maybe a 12 to 14 race duration situation where I'm highly fat adapted, I'm running fastest, and I'm running at a steady state, as opposed to it's not a sport that has any much changes in the intensity and the speed at which I have to go. I don't have to race up hills, or like I'm comparing this to, say, a cycling race, or there's no sprint attack, so to speak, and there's no, so it varies, really varies on how largely adapted, fat adapted you are, what your respiratory quotient is. But I think the understanding that we need to fuel the muscle, when if you're highly fat adapted, you can, and like we said, the fat that's already in the muscle can take care of what you need to, in terms of ATP requirements. The small loading that you need is mainly would be to take on to, like I said, fuel the brain. So, so that was just along with the race preparation of what you said about, how you can improve airport meals and the foods that you can bring with you and some supplements you can take with you is also just the natural kind of gels and drinks and natural foods that you can actually use during a race.
Okay. So, So basically, if we step back and we look at this big picture as far as the five steps that we just went over, the first is to optimize your diet. And it sounds like the big picture there is to not be afraid of eating carbs and real foods and things like that, but just ensure that you're really drenching your diet in a lot of good, healthy fats to shift you into fat oxidation. And all the more so is that true when you're an athlete, when you're already pretty active, and when those carbohydrates are not going to do quite as much damage, and the trick is to get more fats in. Number two would be nutrient timing and making sure that you time your carbohydrates accordingly during the day and try to line them up to your periods of physical activity, and specifically the more intense physical activity of the day. Number three would be to do lots of fasted training and make sure that that's not something that you shy away from with your training. Number four would be make sure you address inflammation from hidden sources like cell phones, Wi-Fi routers, oxidation from like airline travel, stuff like that. And then number five would be, if you're competing, and especially if you're traveling when competing, A, make sure that you're bringing things along with you that allow you to stay in that fat-adapted state and planning ahead to do so. And B would be, don't be afraid to actually include carbohydrates during a big workout. Just know that those are primarily being used for the brain as fuel. You're in a relatively high fat burning state, and taking in some bananas, apples, natural sources of carbohydrates like that is not necessarily going to shift you out of fat oxidation during exercise if you're already fat adapted.
Yeah, and as you know, there's a lot of, we can go into a lot more depth in probably each one of those points and do separate podcasts, but at least
that gives a really good overview, though.
It's a good overview, and it's hopefully it paints a better picture as to what actual fat adaptation is for people, you know.
Cool. Well, this is a really good primer. I like it. It makes it easy. Five easy steps. So here's the deal. If you're listening in, first of all, you can find Barry at greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. He's one of the performance nutritionists over there. In the show notes for this episode, and by the way, if you need the show notes, you just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com, and the show notes are over there for pretty much any episode if you scroll down. But you can also, if you subscribe to the newsletter at bengreenfieldfitness.com, you get the show notes automatically sent to you every time one of these bad boys gets released. And then as far as Barry goes, you can hire him for consulting or nutrition coaching or anything like that. And you can go over to greenfieldfitnesssystems.com and find Barry there if you click on the coaching tab. Now, Barry, one other thing I know that you do, just if anybody's kind of close to you in the area that you're going to be doing this, is you do like live workshops too, right?
Yeah. So just recently kind of teamed up with some two other guys, kind of a running coach and a movement specialist. So what we're trying to do is set up these and base them on the kind of primal aspects of kind of training and eating, and combine everything into kind of one weekend workshop. So we're calling it like the Primal 3, and we're running it out of a place called Glendalough in Wicklow, which is just outside Dublin here in Ireland. So we're going to be running one of those kind of workshop weekends every month, hopefully in the new year. We're trying to use all the principles that I've just discussed in nutrition, but combine that then with MoveNAP principles and mobility and technical, you know, running form. And we're going to target it to, you know, runners, triathletes, cyclists, and a lot of mainly endurance sports, but also to CrossFitters as well.
Cool. So if people contact you, I know your contact information, for example, is over there at Greenfield Fitness Systems. If they want to find more information about that, they can just shoot you off an email.
Yeah, the advertisement, the booking details are on a website called championseverywhere.com. So that's people go to championseverywhere.com, they'll see the details and the information about how to sign up for these primal workshops.
Awesome. Well, folks, if you're listening in and you have questions, comments, or feedback, you can leave them on the show notes for this episode. over at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Don't forget to visit the website of the sponsor for this episode, Casper Mattresses. And when you go to casper.com/Ben, you get $50 off towards any mattress purchase. Again, with promo code Ben at casper.com. And until next week, thanks for listening in and have a healthy week.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.